Well, hello everybody, Thad here, and welcome back to Theotivity. In this episode, I'm going to be talking with my brother-in-law, Josh. Hey, Josh.
Hey.
And we're going to be talking a little bit about Christian communities and building strong communities and just the importance of that. Particularly, I think that's been a pertinent topic to discuss, especially as the world continues to get crazier and crazier. I think a lot more Christians are starting to think in those ways. They're like realizing, oh, we're in real danger of potentially losing jobs and livelihoods, being extra, ex not exercised, ostracized from society.
Excommunicated.
Yeah, basically, that's what is going on, right? Like, because I covered this in a talk I gave recently that what's going on in society is actually a shift of religions, that it's a whole other religion with its own form of discipline, too, right?
Yes.
Church discipline, so to speak, where you're ostracized, you're a pariah of the society, of the cult, right? And that's their form of discipline, cancel culture,
Yeah.
right? But anyways, back to the point. Like, I think the more and more the Christians are starting to realize that this is what's going on in our culture and this cultural moment, we're realizing, oh, you know what? This Christian community thing, we should probably rethink this. And we think that this has a very big, important part to play. I mean, it should have been playing a huger part in this whole discussion of church life anyways, because that's one of the things that we're called to as Christians, to live in community, right? But I think now more than ever, we're feeling it more acutely, right? That it's like, oh, yeah, if all of my other social relationships fall through, who's got my back, right?
Yeah.
If I was to lose my job, who's got my back? We were talking about this recently, like if we're calling Christians to be faithful in the public square and to speak truth, even if it costs you, that might mean that, like, a public school teacher, let's say, might lose their job because they stand against what's going on, let's say, for the LGBTQ movement and so on. And if that happens, then if pastors are calling them to stand for truth no matter what, who are they falling back on? Do we have church communities that'll have our back? That could, you know, I just even think of how encouraging it would be for a churchgoer to hear from their pastor that, like, hey, if you lose your job because you stood up to the woke mob or whatever, like, we've got your back. Like, we'll make sure you have food on the table. We'll rally together. We'll try to help you find another job. Those sorts of things. But just really help, you know, put steel in people's spine.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And not only just the maybe financial concerns, but also just the feeling like, you know, your community is going to be there for you and, you know, a pat on the back being like, hey,
Yeah.
good job standing up for Christ.
Yeah, absolutely. And not be like ostracized from the same community you thought
Yeah.
was gonna have your
Thought
back,
should,
right?
yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I think, like, even, you know, some of that has been experienced over the past 2 years over the various controversies, right? Let the reader understand. Where, you know, some Christians felt like their backs were up against the wall and they were expecting their community to have their backs, but didn't feel like that was happening.
Yes.
And, you know, that's varied across the board in terms of experiences.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, let's get kind of our first point and just jump straight into the meat of this, right? Because that's what you guys are here for, meat,
Not
right?
milk.
Yeah, not milk.
Yeah.
So building strong communities, right? That we were talking about how, like, this concept broader just than just Sunday mornings, right? You want to speak a little bit to that? Like, what do we mean by that? That, you know, if we're gonna build strong communities as Christians, it has to be broader than just a Sunday morning gathering.
Well, I think that, and we've talked about this, I think that the Christian experience in the kingdom of God is more than just inside the church. We're called to be Christians in all areas of life, and Jesus made that clear that all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to him,
Yeah.
which is a lot of authority.
But wait, his kingdom's not of this world, Josh.
That's a whole nother, I'll leave that one to you in a
Yeah.
minute. But
I'm pretty sure by the time this is out, I would have probably dropped an episode on that or two.
yeah,
Yeah.
so we're called to live for Christ in all areas of life. And so part of that is having strong communities that, you know, that looks like the church is important, that looks like families are very important, that looks like Christian businesses are very important, you know, education. There's a whole bunch of different areas that really are part of effectively reaching the world for Christ, I think. And we can't just push it off into assuming that that's only church and that's only Sundays or Wednesday nights or whatever that is.
Yeah.
Much broader than that.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, just practically, what does that look like? I mean, I think of church community. You should this like okay, growing up in Trinidad, like, is a perfect example for me in terms of my church experience, where majority of my friends throughout the week, like Monday through Saturday, were the same people from Sunday, right?
Yeah.
Or, you know, a lot of my friends also I made at church camp. You know, you're a camper too,
Yes.
you understand that,
Yes.
right? And yeah, it's so significantly defined all of my life, right? That community, in church. And I think like that's the way it should look, right? Like you even think, I think in terms of like church discipline, one of the reasons why it should be such an effective tool for pastors to use on someone who's going wayward is that their church community should have defined all of their life such that if they were to lose that, yes, it feels like a big loss.
Yes.
Like if you were just like, you know, waltzing in and out of church, nobody knows you, whatever, and then you're in sin and like the pastors decide to exercise church discipline, it's like, ah, no sweat off your back because you never were invested anyways,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So there's multiple levels where church involvement and community come into play. I think too, just practically speaking, having people over and eating.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's a huge part of building community. Like, mm-hmm, we should eat together more.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Well, and starting within the family.
Yeah.
The statistics on that really drive me a little bit crazy.
Yeah.
That so many families don't eat any meals together.
Mm-hmm.
And so in my family, I was blessed that we ate meals, you know, at least once a day for dinner. We were all getting together, except in very exceptional circumstances.
Right.
Every day we would eat a meal together.
Yeah, and we discount just how life transformational that can be, right? Because if you think about a lot of busy families, especially modern busy families, hardly have any moments to really catch up on each other, figure out what's going on in each other's life. But if you have like this set time of dinner, let's say, that you're sitting around the table, those sorts of casual conversations can happen where you can get caught up and kind of know what's going on.
Yes.
And the people within your own household. Yes. Right?
And then as that feels comfortable, then it also feels very comfortable to invite another family from the church for a Sunday lunch or something, where you're already used to this as a family.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a kind of a networking of hospitality.
Yeah. Rhythms of feasting and fellowship, right?
There it is.
Love it.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. And it feels more natural when somebody, because I think people can feel when it's forced. Like when you invite a guest over and it feels forced, like they know these people actually never really sit down together, right? But if it's just part of your everyday, you know, reality, when you invite someone in, it's more natural because they're just being invited into that reality.
Yes.
I think it can be such like a powerful witness too, because like our culture doesn't eat together, for example, right?
Yes.
You have somebody who's new visitor in church. Like, I mean, that's powerful to be invited into someone's home, not just a restaurant, but into their home and be like, hey, we want to share a meal with you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, very welcoming, and definitely, well, and we were talking about this, Jesus said that he'll know us by our love. And so that's got to be very appealing to the world if we are in that kind of dynamic community with each other.
Absolutely. And if you even think about the way that he's given to us as a sacramental ordinance to proclaim his death till he comes is what? A meal.
Yeah, right.
Right? And the communion was actually partaken in the context of a full meal, not just like the wafer and the, the grape juice, right?
Yes, yes.
It was definitely grape juice.
Right.
But yeah, I even think of like Luke's narrative. I don't know if you've noticed this in Luke's narrative. Jesus is either leaving from a feast or going to a feast.
Mm-hmm.
Like eating is so central in Luke's narrative.
Right.
It's kind of interesting. Just the centrality that it played and how people were wanting Jesus to be a guest in their home and to eat together with him.
Yes.
I think that says something too, if we were to be Christ followers. Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And all this talk about food. I'm sure the listeners are getting hungry.
Next time we'll send snacks out before.
I'm going to just edit in some like pictures of like picanha and like, you know, spaghetti.
You're making me hungry now.
Cool. Well, we were talking about, you know, in terms of building Christian communities. Okay, awesome. So eating together for sure. One of the ways that you can do that just real practically. But we were also talking about like strategy and incrementalism and like starting local. You want to kick us off on that?
Yeah. Well, I think that it is important that we have a big picture.
Mm.
We have this tendency to be very reactive.
Yeah.
And so we'll see something happening in culture and we're like, oh, that's not great, or something like we don't like that, or this would be better. And so we're very reactive, but we don't very often sit down and think of what do we want the world by God's grace to look like in 10 years or 20 years or 50 years or 200 years.
Yeah.
And so I don't think you can build anything very effective by always reacting to what's going wrong.
Yeah.
You have to have a solid vision of what the future is going to look like.
Yeah.
And so we gotta.
And that's why it feels like the church is always playing catch up too, because you're always just reacting.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Never proactive.
And that's, it's also very defeating,
because
you never feel like there's not a positive vision. It's always a negative vision.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is what we're against.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is not really what Christ was known for either.
Mm-hmm.
Like Christ was very direct, and maybe of anyone in scripture, Christ said some of the most direct and hard to accept things.
Yeah.
But people didn't think of him as a hard to accept person. In fact, they really wanted to be with him because...
Well, some people did. The Pharisees did.
The Pharisees did.
Yeah.
The kind of people that we would like to reach. The,
right.
You know, the people that Jesus said he came for.
Yeah, yeah.
The ones who need the doctor.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Wanted to be with him.
Yeah.
And I I think part of that might be because Jesus had an outlook on life that was exciting,
right?
Fun to be around.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's definitely true. I think like there's been a malaise, let's say, of pessimism around churches and evangelicalism in general, which I mean, I think is very much tied to dispensational sort of forms of thought. But regardless of like the eschatological issues and so on, I think it's not very inspiring to people. Like you think about the sports analogy, right? Where if you've got a coach that goes into a sports team and it's like, all right, guys, we're going to fight our hardest. We're going to play our best. We're going to lose anyway, but you're going to give it your all. Like that's not very motivational, right?
Right.
It's not going to inspire like really the type of performance that you want to get out of people, right? And not that it's all pragmatics, but it does play, I think, an important aspect. You know, if you have a more optimistic sort of tone as opposed to a pessimistic tone where you're just like, oh, well, you know, this is fated to be. Like sometimes we talk like pagans, really, in terms of blind fate. Mm-hmm. Like there's nothing I can do to change this fate, right? But that's actually a pagan notion, not Christian notion. You know, God does use means and causes. And ultimately, obviously, he's sovereign over the course of history.
Yeah.
But I don't think like he ever calls us to pessimism.
No.
Yeah.
No. And like Jesus is the least pessimistic person I can think of. Mm-hmm. And he went to the cross.
Yeah.
Right. But he saw the vision beyond that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, I think it's much more exciting. And I also think that in our proclamation of the gospel in terms of salvation, I think that that is also very appealing to people, where you're giving a whole vision, you're giving a whole worldview that really encapsulates all of life in an optimistic way.
Mm.
That's something that's a lot more exciting to welcome people into and to offer them to join.
Okay, yeah. So, you know, optimism is a huge asset. I can see that. And I think the overall tenor and tone of scripture should lead us towards that. Not this sort of dour fatalism, let's say, right? But I think also there's this wisdom towards thinking strategically and incrementally also, right? I remember there's a pretty well-known pastor and theologian who, you know, kind of made a ridicule of postmillennial sort of thought, saying, oh, you thought you're just going to waltz into the kingdom and whatnot, right? But the thing is, like, I don't think any true postmillennial thinks that, like, you know, for me, I'm a postmillennial, and I think that, no, it's going to be through many trials that you get to the kingdom. That's what Jesus guaranteed, right?
Yeah.
It's not going to be easy going. And I think all eschatologies would affirm that, right? That there's not this idea in the Bible of, like, just an easy life. It's actually guaranteed just the opposite, right?
Yes.
But also with that, I think, comes the wisdom of, like, well, we need to strategize, right? Like, especially if you're expecting hard times.
Yes.
No one should be like, oh, man, times are going to get hard. Okay, well, I guess I'm going to play some more Game Boy or whatever. Like, yes. I'm not, like, strategize after how you're going to weather the storm.
Yeah, scroll some more Instagram.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, like, let's talk a little bit about that. Like, strategy, incrementalism. Like, how does that sort of mindset help in this greater project of building strong communities and, you know, hopefully changing culture through that?
Yeah. Well, I think that we need to... The first thing, obviously, is just putting a little thought into it and starting to have the conversation.
Yeah.
And so just a shift of mindset in towards thinking a little bit more long term and including, you know, generations don't, it doesn't take very long before you have another generation. You're looking at, you know, 20 years maybe before you have infants who have now grown up to be adults who are capable of making a huge difference in the world.
Yeah.
And so that's one way. Like, I think kids we shouldn't treat as a distraction, but as a essential part of.
Yeah.
So it's just, I think, just a little bit of a mindset shift and just having the conversation.
Yeah.
It's a pretty good part.
It's also rethinking your projection timelines too, right? I think right now we're very in the immediacy sort of thing. Like, what works for now, what's trending, right? Yes. That's the whole thing.
Yes.
And I think the church can get caught up into that in a bad way, right? Like, I think it's good to be aware of what's trending, let's say.
Yeah.
Because you do need to speak to the cultural moment. But in terms of planning and how ministry should be laid out and so on, this is not just for churches, but for Christians as well. Like, we need to, like, elongate basically our projections and, you know, start thinking generationally, like like you were saying, you know, not just how is this going to benefit me and set me up well, but how am I planning for potentially setting something in place that my great-grandchildren will benefit from, that I wouldn't even live to see the fruits of the seed that I just planted, right? Like, that's real generational kind of thinking. And I think, like, we underestimate just how significantly you can transform society within the case of like one or two generations. We've seen that in our lifetime.
Yes.
Right? Like, I'm old enough to remember a time where like the whole LGBTQ stuff was not even all of the letters yet. Right? There was the L and the G. And within the space of my lifetime, the whole world has changed on this thing. Yes. And that's not even two proper generations, really.
Yes.
So you can see how very quickly, if you're strategic about it, and the LGBTQ agenda was very strategic, that you can practically impact quite a lot of people and make a lot of cultural change.
Yes, and I think one of the parts of that that we can learn from is that you have to pick the places where you're going to be most effective.
Yes,
and so that a lot of that is kids.
Yeah,
that is various forms of education. That's various forms of media, and the places where people spend a lot of their time, and the places where people, especially I think places where people spend a lot of mindless time. Because that's where you end up entertainment. That's where your subconscious values get formed.
Yeah. I can't remember who said it. Some famous American history personality or whatever. But basically said, like, I don't care who writes the nation's laws. Let me write its songs.
Mm.
I think that's super insightful.
Yes.
Because, yeah, who goes and studies a nation's laws? Nobody really, right?
Yes.
But the songs, the creative aspects, the art in the culture, the entertainment, those have a subconscious effect on people that's huge that we often discount, we don't see. Like, why is it such a big deal, for example, that Disney's putting out so many movies promoting a certain agenda? Well, because that's how you change culture.
Mm-hmm.
You don't change culture by like necessarily writing a whole bunch of books or laws or, you know, even with politicians. I think actually entertainment may have more sway on culture than even the most powerful politician.
Yes. And I think one of the aspects of thinking strategically here is we need to stop telling people who are interested in media and arts and those sorts of things to go get a real job. Understandably, it's important to earn a living, but there are lots of ways that you can learn a living in creative work and either on the side or as your actual full-time creative work be creating things that are moving the kingdom forward.
And not just in terms of like creating tracks, right?
Yes.
Because that's the next thing too, is like you have this whole industry of cheesy Christian movies
that
are terrible because the only people who watch cheesy Christian movies are like the kind of elderly grandmas who like that kind of stuff who are already Christian, and those aren't the people you're trying to reach, right? So then the outside culture looks at that as like a kind of subculture that they turn a nose up to, right?
Yes.
Because it's actually not, it's not telling the truth, really. They're cheesy because the whole storyline is not honest to what reality actually is. You know, like the atheist in the movie all of a sudden, you know, bows any to Christ, and like, you know, everybody's singing at the end, and grandma who died resurrects, and just it's just so cheesy because it's like such a neat wrap up of a story and like a happy ending, and like it's moralistic too usually, right? It's not telling complex stories, doesn't have complex characters. It doesn't address the shades of nuance within reality. I think people look at that and they know that's fake, right?
Well, and I think that that's also, it's exactly the symptom of the same thing where it's short term and it's immediate. Where we want all of the payoffs for everything in one movie. Where if we thought that we're doing a 20-year project of creating media that points people to Christ, you have some time to explore not all of the issues in a single film.
You can do it over multiple different films over decades even.
But as it is, I think there's this mindset of sort of scarcity that we're only ever going to get to make one thing. So we have to make sure
do everything.
We have to get sin, we have to get redemption, we have to get the cross, we have to like sing some hymns, and we have to do everything else in one thing.
You have to get the consummation in there too.
Right.
Because grandma gets raptured after she's resurrected.
We're just trying to do everything at once.
And
everything at once is not very effective at anything. Jack of all trades and a master of none.
Absolutely. Okay, so incrementalism then. How does that play in? Like, so, you know, to that point, I think it's definitely connected, right? That we want to try to do everything all at once. And we just have to realize our finitude. And the fact that also, even if you were able to do everything all at once well, it might not be the most effective way to do things. Because people don't change usually all at once. They change incrementally. And also culture, I would say, changes incrementally too. You want to talk a little bit to that?
Yeah, so I think a big part of that is changing our mindset about, and again, getting everything done all at the same time, and then also how much we're trying to get done in any single step. Mm. And part of that is maybe, in a sense, dialing back our expectations a little bit, mm. and also dialing back our egos a little bit. Mm. And so I was really impacted. Ronald Reagan said one time that there's no limit to what a man can achieve if he doesn't care who gets the credit. Mm. And I think that there's a little bit of that. We want to do the thing that makes a big difference, and we want it all in one go.
Yeah.
And I think if you're willing to just, you know, gently encourage for change and gently encourage for things to be better and more Christ-like, you go a lot further than if you, you know, stand on your pedestal and start shouting about stuff.
Right.
And so there's a little bit of that. You just got to, you know, there's a little of letting go of the ego and saying, hey, I'm here for Christ. And if someone else gets all the credit in 10 years for legwork that I've done now, then I guess to God be the glory.
Yeah, absolutely. That's good. You know, Jesus had a appropriate critique, I think, of Christians, right? He said that the sons of this world are often more crafty in their dealings than the sons of light, right? And I think that's true today as well. And that we can actually learn something from the sons of this world in this whole point of incrementalism. And not to harp on the LGBTQ thing again, but they were incremental as well. Like, they didn't try to do everything all at once, because they knew back, let's say 60 years ago, if they tried to, society would just outright reject it. Mm-hmm. So they did it incrementally. The first step was, okay, we need to start to identify our sexual preferences with identity, because then now you've changed the conversation from the things that you do to the thing that you are. And then now you're attacking the person rather than the issue. Mm-hmm. So that framed the conversation differently. Mm-hmm. And just incrementally, they started to inject things like, such as, you know, taking over institutions of learning and entertainment, like you were talking before, right? Like, why is it that every, you know, non-binary or non-straight character in movies and TV is never, ever portrayed in a bad light? They're always the life of the party, the humorous, the funny one. You know, it's because, again, they're incrementally trying to change the perception of society to be favorable towards their cause. And over time, that had effect. Like, initially, when they were starting to make those pushes, society kind of, you know, was a little resistant to it. Now there's almost no resistance at all. Mm. And again, that's the fruit of incrementalism. And that was done, I would say this, that was done by people without the Spirit's empowerment. How much more so if, like, Christians who have the Spirit's empowerment and blessing and wisdom and scriptures to guide them as well, took that sort of approach of incrementalism. And also strategic planning and saying, okay, this is where we want to be. We can't get there tomorrow, but we could get there in 50 years, let's say.
Yes.
And what are the steps we need to make to get there along the way?
How much better could we make the world, and how much closer to Christ?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and that's it's exciting to think about the possibilities there.
Yeah.
And one part of the incremental thing too is you touched on it briefly about language and so how you frame the conversation. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's because as believers, we tend to be, you know, friendly. We don't want to, we tend to not like to make issues and that sort of thing. Yeah. And so when someone reframes the conversation, we tend to just step into the new conversation that they've framed.
Yeah.
And the way that you set up a conversation really sets you up for whether it's even possible to have a Christian outlook in that conversation. So if we just sort of accept, you know, if someone brings up an objection about the gospel or an objection about Christ, if we just sort of take their question at face value in the words that they stated it, sometimes that completely precludes you from actually giving a Christian answer. Because the question, it's impossible to answer certain questions without evaluating the question itself first.
Absolutely. That's a good point. Let's move it forward. So we were also talking about, you know, in terms of building strong communities, there are, like, kind of three areas we wanted to touch on in terms of, like, how do you build strong communities? You know, one was the family, the next one was the church, and then we talked a little bit about businesses. Let's start talking a little bit about that. We touched a little bit on family already, but maybe you want to say a little bit more towards that. Like, how do building strong families then affect this project of building strong communities, which then affect, you know, strong cultures? Because culture is really just a conglomeration of different, you know, communities, right? Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. So families are very important because they're bedrock of every other aspect of community.
Yeah.
But they're also, you know, that's where children are raised, and children are sort of by definition the next step of incrementalism.
Yeah.
So that's very important. You have a huge impact, probably perhaps more impact in raising children than you do in anything else that is going to be done in life, because you're, it's an incremental expansion of your own ability to do things.
Yeah. And that's also what the Bible says, right?
Like yes.
Psalm, what is it, 127, that you run out arrows in the hands of a warrior. Blessed is he who fills his quiver, right?
Full of them.
Yes. Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, and a lot of Christians don't think this way of children as ammo, right? As like arrows are offensive weapons, right? That you sharpen them up and shoot them out.
Shoot it.
And they go further than you could ever reach, right? So we should start thinking of children that way. And there's no sense in handing your arrows over to your enemy.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So you got to make sure that they're sharp in your own quiver.
Yes.
And then, you know, that once they're mature, you can send them out. They can reach further than you can.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Also, I think there's a sense where your home life has a big influence on how much you're capable of doing in other areas. And you'll see this sometimes, people whose home life is not encouraging, they're down about it. They don't have the drive to make other things happen because, you know, you're coming home and you're getting put down, or it's a place that's not peaceful or that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so I think to build strong families is actually very encouraging to then feel like, okay, you have a foundation that now you can go.
Yeah,
you know, make a difference in other places as
absolutely
well.
I believe like the family is like a microcosm of society and also of churches. I mean, you look at like qualifications for pastors and elders and deacons, like all the officers of the church, it's all family life, right? It's all family driven, and the church itself is called the family of God, the household of God, right? So the family, in terms of like actual families, like biological families, they are a microcosm of then what happens in the church, and then also what happens, I think, in larger society as well. And you see this reflected within trends within society. Like you look at the trend towards, like, as divorce rates increase, basically, where does society go, right? As you have this epidemic more fatherless boys, particularly, you have increases in crime that's correlated. Very, very, very hard correlation.
Yes.
So what happens in the family will inevitably transform churches and also transform society. Yes. And I think it's also why like family ministry and how we think biblically about that is of real big importance within churches. I don't think there's been enough on biblical thought, but also intentional thought on that, about what is actually the biblical model for family ministry and for families themselves. And then also expending a lot of energy and resources into building strong families and helping families that are struggling. Right. You look at a church's budget and it can tell you a lot of like where the priorities lie. Right. And I think just recognizing the fundamental importance of family, it should be a pretty significant part of the budget because that'll tell you where the priorities lie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think there's been a sense perhaps for quite some time that dads and fathers are, they go out to work or whatever they are, but that they're not as responsible for the development of the family, which is kind of exactly the opposite of God's word, which says that, you know, fathers are very responsible for their children and their families.
Yeah.
And so to kind of cast that vision is actually, it's motivating and exciting because I think people step up to the bar that you set. So if you set a low bar, people are going to probably miss the low bar. Yes. Yeah, trying to figure out a way of kind of slipping underneath. Yeah. If you set a high bar, and even if it's a bar that's a little bit higher than, I mean, that's what Christ does. He says, you must be perfect as your Father is perfect. And that's a very high bar.
Yeah.
And so you set a higher bar, and then I think we're often shocked at what people rise to when we expect it.
Yeah, yeah. It's been called the soft bigotry of low expectations before. You know, that in a way you... I get, like, you know, it's a complicated thing as you're thinking as a pastor how you preach and feed all of the sheep. But if you're only aiming for the lowest common denominator of, like, that's all the level that your church will ever rise to, right? In a sense, it's good to preach a little bit above their heads because it gives them something, like you're saying, to reach to, right? That, and it's okay for people to feel when they sit down in church, like, oh, I didn't quite get everything that was going on here. Like, I might have some work to do here. Yeah. Like, especially men, I think, rise to challenges. Men like to be challenged. But unfortunately, I think a lot of church culture has become a little bit effeminate, to be honest. And sort of will tend to pander towards that more feminine side. And that's also, I think, downstream from the breakdown of families, right? Because you don't have men leading in their homes. And usually it'll be single moms or moms who are still married, but bringing the kids to church, but dad's not coming to church. Then you have a church full of like women, basically, that are the predominant givers and active people within a church. And that just shapes the culture of churches. That, I think, has been an ongoing problem with evangelicalism and just churches in general. And it can affect, I think, how elders and pastors think about leading churches and the tone and tenor that it takes, right? Because if you don't have men present and you're speaking predominantly to women, there's a certain tone that comes out just naturally. I don't think it's always meant to be a bad thing. Like, I think it's just something that happens unwittingly.
Mm-hmm.
But it's something that we need to be aware of, right? And the way to remedy that is not to continue in those patterns. It's actually to change the tone and tenor of the ministry so that a man who comes in is like, oh, I actually resonate with this. Oh, I'm actually challenged by what this guy is saying. Oh, this guy looks like a strong leader. I can follow him.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because men won't follow like a weak, limp-wristed guy into battle, but they'll follow like a strong guy, right? Who seems to know what he's about, bold in what he's saying, clear what he's saying. I think we need more of that.
Yeah. And I think a lot of this is we've allowed ourselves to be discipled by our culture. And so we need to remember that God intentionally created men and women different, both very good, but different.
Yeah.
And so we can't assume that the same approach works equally.
Yeah.
And so an approach that's going to work very well for women, it might be different than an approach that works well for men. And you need to figure out a way of how that works in a church context to speak to both in appropriate, in appropriate settings. Yeah. And I think also to find ways, especially for boys, to communicate to them that they're men a lot sooner than our culture would tell them they're men.
Yeah. Get rid of this whole adolescent phase.
Yes.
It's a fiction.
Yes.
Like, it's not biblical. It's actually the product of like just secular psychology, really.
Mm-hmm.
But biblically speaking, a boy became a man like basically at 13. Like, you look at like traditional Jews now, even still, will celebrate a bar mitzvah, and that's a boy's coming of age. He's becoming a man, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there was no transition from boy to adolescent, then to man. It was boy, man.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And I think we kind of need to recover that, because it changes the way that you talk to now your boys who are becoming men, right?
Yes.
That you should address them as, like, this is what you're aspiring to be, is a man, not an adolescent, right?
Yeah. Now, on the point of incrementalism, the problem I think we have right now is that a lot of guys don't really think that they're even starting to become adults until they graduate college or university.
Yeah.
And so maybe to be incremental, we don't try and push all the way back to 13.
Right.
Maybe we say, hey, you're an adult when you enter college.
Yeah.
You know, and high expectations and all that. But I think that it possibly, if you start to try and push this too far, then people are going to say, whoa, this is like, that's crazy. Someone couldn't possibly be an adult at 15.
Right.
And so there's a little bit of like, okay, We're in a bad place right now where like 24 is considered maybe sort of possibly the start of adult, but maybe it's 30.
Yeah.
Right. So, but like maybe we can get back to 18.
Right.
And have a perception that at 18, we're expecting you to be a full member of the church. Like you should probably come to members meetings and know what's going on. And you know, have input, raise your hand and ask some questions.
Right. Yeah.
Not just stay in the background.
I think that's a reasonable expectation. Also, I'm okay with challenging people a little bit beyond. Is particularly if you can show them from the Bible. You know, there's no reason towards say like denying something that scripture would, you know, pretty clearly state, right? And I think like you can make a pretty strong case that there's no such thing as adolescence. And just getting people to think, oh yeah, scripture should challenge the way that we think about like how the culture tells us you know, reality is, right? Anyways, let's kind of move on to another point, not to belabor on this. But in terms of, you know, strong churches, obviously super important to building strong communities, right? The church is a pillar and buttress of the truth. The church is God's instrument by which he trains up and then grows his kingdom through disciples, right? And then also, like, the church is a light within the community, right? So definitely should be engaged in multifaceted ways within the community, and that helps to build strong communities. I think also something that's neglected, particularly oddly here in North America, I feel like in the Caribbean growing up, we did this a little bit, I wouldn't say better, but yeah, we did this better, is that churches tended to network more and do things together more. Here, I find there's a lot of like this individual church here, and they're all each kind of independently doing their own thing, but hardly ever get together to do things together, even when there's really strong alignment theologically, which I find odd and perhaps something that should change, because yeah, we're better together.
Yes.
But moving, shifting a little bit out of just the ecclesiastical sphere, we talked a little bit about businesses and how that's important also towards building strong communities. Why?
Yes. Well, I think there's a few things going on there. One of them is that we believe in a sphere sovereignty. And so we don't think, we believe that the kingdom is is all of Christ for all of life, as mm-hmm. you know, as some have said, yeah. which I think is a good summary of biblical principles.
Yeah.
But the church should not be, you know, operating the business world. That's not a good idea. The church shouldn't be operating the political world.
Yeah.
And so we have different spheres, but that doesn't mean that Christian life and Christ has no place in business. And so if the church shouldn't be running businesses, but Christ is part of it, then who should?
Right.
It's the members of the churches yeah. who should be going out and building the kingdom of God through being very thoughtful and Christian about how they build businesses that serve people. And maybe that's an aside, but I really feel that business is actually an opportunity to serve people.
Yeah.
And there's this sense often that business is all about money, but
yeah.
by definition, if someone buys your product or service, your product or service is worth more to them than the money they gave you for it. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they would never have bought it.
Right.
And so it makes everyone's life better by definition.
Yeah.
And so I think we need to recover a sense of business as service instead of business as greed.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a biblical concept too. I mean, Paul talks about this in his first century context in terms of master-slave relationships and how you should serve your master, not as just eye pleasers, but you're serving the Lord Christ, right? Mm-hmm. That ultimately the one that you're serving is Jesus Christ, right? And that falls into his kingdom as well, right? And I think as business owners and even employees within businesses, like that's the way to think too, right? That ultimately the one who I'm serving is Christ and his kingdom. And that's why I'll provide excellent service or produce excellent products at a fair price is because ultimately that's the master that I'm accountable to. And also for love of neighbor and so on. Like we tend to sometimes talk about, oh, we need to love our neighbor in all of these different ways, maybe in terms of outreach or in terms of like charitable causes. And that's definitely within the pale of it. But we hardly ever talk about loving our neighbor in terms of, well, running a good business, providing a good service or producing good products.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I saw something recently about someone who would overpay for products that were sold by people in need.
Yeah.
And when asked by his kids, like, why are you paying more than they asked for? Mm-hmm. He said, well, it's a charity wrapped in a dignity. And so just handing out money to people is, it could be like, oh, that's how we love our neighbor. We do things for free.
Yeah.
But sometimes also you can do things in a way that are economically viable, but also also really help the situation,
right,
which also gives people the dignity of work.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's something that's lost on our culture, especially up here in Canada, where you have such a huge welfare state, right? Mm-hmm. Where literally, depending on the individual, if they're willing to abuse the system, they could totally abuse the system and like live off of welfare, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's not biblical because Paul says that if a man is not willing to work, let him not eat. Mm-hmm. And hunger is a great motivation to work,
right?
But we rob people of that motivation towards good, godly work and earning honest living.
Yes. It,
by implementing our welfare state. And actually, that's nowhere in the Bible is the civil government given the ministry of welfare. That's actually given to the family, right? That and the church as well, right? That we're to care for those who are truly orphans and widows, right? Like, so there is a legitimate a category of people who need welfare, but not like how our current status-run welfare is.
Yeah, very wasteful too.
Yes, yeah.
It's shocking sometimes to hear stories you hear of how wasteful these systems are because government doesn't have incentive to be not wasteful.
Yeah, and it's inept to do it. It's not been given the tools by God to do it. Right? It's not his role, so it's not qualified to do it. The one tool that God gives to the government is a sword, which is, compulsion. Right?
It's not a good way to run
coercion,
a business.
Yeah, it's not a good way to run a business, not a good way to run welfare. So they've got one very narrow job by God that they should stick to. But anyways, bringing it back to businesses and so on, in terms of building strong communities, we talked also about, just the frustration sometimes as Christian business owners and even creatives. It's irony, but it's true and sadly true that like you sometimes groan at working with Christians or having Christian clients, because unfortunately the culture within Christendom and a lot of Christians is that if they know, oh, my brother Josh, he has a business doing whatever, they'll come to Josh and be like, hey, so can you give me a discount? We go to the same church. Like, yeah. And like are asking either like, or we'll come up to somebody who's, let's say, a lawyer or whatever and trying to dig out free legal advice, basically.
Yes, right.
Want to comment a little bit on that?
Yeah, I think that is a big problem.
Yeah,
for sure. There's this sense of always needing a deal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a big part of that is that Christians should be generous.
Yeah.
And so we tend to be especially long-suffering about that in a way that that the world wouldn't be if you were trying to just sort of fish for professional advice for free.
Yeah, that's an irony, right? You would never do that with like your Muslim business owner or like a Hindu lawyer or whatever.
Or a secular even. Like they just, you wouldn't do that.
That's
not cool. So I think that we sometimes take advantage of our own scriptural principles.
Yes.
Which isn't, it's a good thing that we have the principles.
Right.
Let's just think about being scriptural in all of the ways.
Yeah, absolutely.
So.
Well, also even to bring scripture into it. And I think framing it this way might be sharp, but I think it's actually quite biblical that when Christians come to a Christian business owner or a Christian creative or whoever, and they're trying to always look for a deal and underpay or whatever it is, just because that person is a brother and they think that they're owed some sort of favor, scripture actually says that you're defrauding your brother, right? That's one of Paul's actually imperatives to, I forget which letter he's writing the church to, but he says, like, don't defraud one another. But we never think about that in terms of defrauding.
Yeah.
Like, when you're not paying what a brother's work is worth, not paying his actual price, you're defrauding him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sin. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a message I've never heard preached that I would wish I would hear preached from the pulpit, because it needs to be preached.
Yes.
That sort of culture is not good. It's toxic within Christendom. And it's also not going to lead to building strong communities, because businesses play a big part of communities, because businesses are how communities get things done, how communities are supplied with the essentials of life and so on.
Yes.
So, I mean, if we want to see strong Christian communities particularly, we need to be, if anything, if you know your brother has a business, like, pay him more.
Right. Yes.
or at least pay him his full price, right? And not presume that he's going to give you things for free, and not presume that you should be entitled to a discount or whatever. Like, go ask a discount to your Muslim, like, neighbor, you know, business, or to the pagan down the street, right? Like, don't do that from a brother, especially. I mean, in general, you shouldn't defraud anybody. So don't go, like, being cheap, even with Muslims and pagans.
This is not advice.
Yeah, this is not saying, like, you know, anyways. This is not advice to go defraud other people.
But don't do it within the church.
Yes, especially don't do it.
Right.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the reason perhaps some of this happens is we, as Christians, tend to have a bit of a mindset of a scarcity.
Yes.
That there's not enough to go around.
Yeah.
And so we have to just stretch every dollar as far as we can.
Yeah.
And I really don't think that that's a Christian concept
right.
at all. I think that actually God is a generous God. He's given us far more resources in the natural world than we could possibly consume.
Yeah.
And so God is generous. And I think we should be generous as well. And the more that we have that generous, it doesn't actually, doesn't mean that we have less. It means that everyone has more.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when you don't pay your Christian brothers and sisters enough for the services they provide, you're weakening their business.
Yep.
And now their business is weaker and isn't going to be able to support your business and isn't going to be able to support the church. And so I think everyone loses when we aren't willing to say, this is what the work is worth.
Yeah.
And let's just pay for it.
Absolutely. And I think that comes actually from how the culture and the ideologies within the culture seeped into the church too, right? That idea of scarcity and that there's this limited pot or pie, right? Mm-hmm. And just because this person got this slice of the pie, that means I get a smaller slice of the pie, right? But that's actually not even how economies work. There's several planes of economic thought. But I think the one that's biblical and right actually sees economies as able to grow and multiply, not as like this fixed pie that you can only get your slice out of, but actually that pie multiplies, that as people are innovative and create new things, new products, new businesses and so on, it actually increases and multiplies the wealth within the economy. So we should really start to change the way that we think in terms of, you know, scarcity versus what's the word they use?
Abundance.
Yeah, abundance. Yeah. Yes. And not in like the prosperity gospel sort of way either, right? This is just like basic economics sort of thing.
Yes.
Right? That as more value is added to the market, then more wealth is generated. That's actually how true wealth is generated.
Yes.
And I think like the whole socialist and Marxist sort of idea, it goes in the opposite direction, where it starts to demonize people who are rich, saying that, oh, because they're rich, that means that the other people have less.
Mm.
That's not actually true, right? Because if, let's say, somebody, you know, we have technology and whatever, right, invents phone or whatever and starts selling that, it doesn't now mean that everybody else is impoverished because of it. Actually, just the opposite.
Yes.
People are now have more wealth because now I have this device that can make me more productive, right?
Yes.
That can be put to use in other ways to produce work.
Yes. Well, I think it's interesting that it's relative because the resources that even not particularly wealthy people today in North America have are are would be considered very wealthy in other parts of the world, and then if you go back throughout history, would be considered fabulously wealthy.
Yes,
the sort of resources, you know, the access to information we have, the the access to clean running water, hot water.
Yeah,
that's the sort of thing that only the very richest, and maybe no one at all, would have had in many previous cultures. And so, so in order to try and assign some sort of like definitive level at which something is wealthy or not wealthy is really very difficult.
And
so I think the same thing goes with when we're thinking about abundance and scarcity and that sort of thing. There is actually a lot of abundance right now in our cultures because people have worked hard and have created, you know, more value for everyone to the fact that most people now have far, far more than people had a few hundred years ago.
And, you know, it's kind of tied to part of what we're created to do in terms of the creation mandate to take dominion, to subdue the earth, to make it flourish, right? That was part of God's initial command to Adam and Eve, and it's not been rescinded. It's actually been repeated throughout scripture, right? And that's what we're to do as Christians. Actually, that's one of the reasons I think it's a good godly Christian thing for Christians to start or consider starting businesses too. Obviously, with the understanding not everybody can start a business, right? But I think it is a good impulse because you are then taking dominion of a certain sphere within the economy, within the market and so on, and creating and making flourishing happen by taking the raw materials of creation and turning it into something productive, right? And I think that's a very Christian impulse.
Oh, well, and one of the things, and we're both, you know, business owners, entrepreneurs, and so that it's interesting to see how when you own something, you're a lot, you're thinking a lot more in terms of efficiency, and you're thinking a lot more in terms of what services can we can provide and how can we network, that sort of thing. Where if you are just working for someone else, it's quite a lot easier to, you know, you go to work for nine, you come home at five.
Check in, and, check out.
And check in, check out is not creation mandate of, you know, fill the earth and subdue it. And so there's a way, I think, in which actually being a business owner helps disciple you in in being more Christian and following more. Not to say that people don't
I'll just kind of qualify that.
Be careful. But it's is, I think it's a way that helps to push you towards thinking about these things. Now, if you you're an employee, you work for someone else, Paul is very clear there that you do everything as working towards the Lord. And so I think it'd be helpful even as an employee to think entrepreneurially about how, okay, how can I make my boss more money? And I think that that's something that's not really thought about very often, you know, maybe anyone, but certainly not Christian employees, is that the way business works is if you make your boss more money, he's going to be able to pay you more money for your services. And so rather than feeling like, oh, I'm not getting paid enough, it's like, okay, how can I add more value and create more value for my employer and for the world? And just the way that God's created the world, the worker deserves his wages. And so that comes back to you. And that's
that,
not
that
a bad
set
thing.
That would set apart Christian workers so much, right?
Like, everyone would want to hire Christians.
Yeah, maybe we would be, you know, not as discriminated against the hiring world.
And, well, and so that brings, us, that brings us to another point, is that I think that's one of the reasons why Christian business is going to be important in in moving forward, is because there is increasing discrimination against people who are willing to stand for Christ.
Yeah, and let's harp on that point a little bit, because I think as the times get harder and harder, and potential towards getting even worse than even where we're at right now, we need to build some sort of parallel economy, right? Especially if Christians, for the sake of Christ, are being ostracized from public life and society. You know, you have to think about, like, where am I going to shop for my groceries? Where am I going to go get my car fixed? Where am I going to, you know, fill in the blank? And if it gets to a level in society where, you know, it becomes difficult just because of your faith commitments towards, you know, both getting employment and also getting services and goods, it becomes very important to start thinking about how we build Christian businesses, but not just individual businesses, but individuals that network together and form a core backbone of the Christians, you know, subculture, let's say, or parallel culture, I should rather say.
And ultimately that again is a long-term thing. Where we, if we're building strong communities that have the ability to provide the services required to live, that gives us a lot more flexibility as believers to influence the places that we live and also create places that are influenced by Christ, so that the culture of our Christian community shows what a Christian society should look like. And I think that that's very attractive.
Yeah. And what you said there actually reminded me of something that, like, you, especially when our culture gets to the point, you know, of decline, kind of where we're heading, it's hard to mount any sort of offense or progress forward from a place of weakness. We need to build pockets of strength mm-hmm. that we can then move forward in. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a category such as strategic retreat. I'm not a retreatist by any means, right? But I do think like that there may come, for some people, a point where it actually makes more sense for them to say, okay, you know, where I am, perhaps in the city or whatever, it's too hard. Like, I'm such a small drop in the bucket here that I could live my whole life going hard as I can at it, being faithful as I can at it, and not make much of a difference here. But if I moved out, let's say, to a smaller town, my impact might be felt a lot more. And not only that, like, you know, potentially there may be more like-minded people who, if they're willing to move to the same place, you develop like a center of strength, basically, that can then now, you know, you build strength, and over a generation, you can launch out again from there. And that's a hard thing to really discern when that point is. And I think mm-hmm. it's different for different people.
Yes.
Not going to venture yet to kind of see what our marker is to see when you should flee, when you should stay and fight.
Well, I think that the early church fled from Jerusalem when they were persecuted. And so I don't think that every time saying, okay, mm-hmm. like it's time to leave.
Yeah.
That's not always, but we want to be careful that we don't leave too soon.
Yes.
And I think there's a tendency to leave too soon. And so every time things start to go a little bit bad, we just abandon it.
Yeah.
And
also fleeing doesn't necessarily mean like a total like retreat from the whole country, let's say, right? Like, for example, I know there's a lot of Canadians after, you know, COVID and all that, like they found it really appealing to move to America as the promised land, right? Or whatever, right? I don't think that's, and there's nothing inherently sinful in that, but I don't think it's necessarily the solution either, right? That there's legitimate options even staying within Canada and you just move to a different part where mm-hmm. you think that, okay, I can build strong community here and build a place of strength from which we can then now start to look at even mounting some sort of offense. Because if you're always in defensive mode where you're located, it's hard to even think strategically about like, okay, what can I do like progressively and proactively to move the ball forward, so to speak.
Right? And I think it's important to think here that there are multiple different ways that the kingdom of God comes and so or moves forward in the world.
Yeah.
And so there's, you know, for example, there's individual evangelism, which mm-hmm. obviously you can do in, you know, a very godless place.
Right.
But then there's also, you know, building a good open public Christian community, which you mm-hmm. can't do in a place like, you know, North Korea, for example.
Right.
You're not going to be able to build a public Christian community.
Mm-hmm.
And so in some ways, you know, depending on what the Lord leads us to mm-hmm. each in, you know, strategically for the gospel.
Yeah. Bringing it back to the Christian businesses point, though, in terms of building Christian communities that are strong and create centers of strength by which we can, you know, start to affect culture and so on. I think like part of that as well, yes, businesses, you know, Christians establishing businesses and then also those businesses networking together and becoming an integral part of the community. But to your point of like, even for the Christians who are not going to be business owners, who are going to be workers, that's super important too, because what's a business without any employees,
yes.
right? You need to actually have a pool from which you can hire from,
yes.
right? And you need to know that pool of people who are hireable are actually worthwhile workers,
yes.
right? So super important as well. Like, I think even for Christians who aren't going to be business owners, you still play a very integral role in that like perhaps, okay, you might not be the business owner, but you're going to be perhaps the Christian business, like employee within the businesses that mm-hmm. will help to build that business to be something, you know, better than it would be as just like a secular business. And I'm very much pro explicit Christian businesses. I don't know what you think about that, but mm-hmm. like, I know for myself, thinking as like I'm starting my business and wanting to build that, and, you know, maybe I'll change it in the future, but I want to take the risk of trying it and just being, you know, super explicit about like, this is the values of this business. Like, we serve the Lord Christ and see kind of what happens with that. I think there is something powerful about businesses that are willing to do that, especially in light of our woke culture. So I think there's a test case going on right now, actually.
Yes.
You know, you know what I'm talking about. Like, you look at like all these woke corporations that are, it's month of June right now when we're recording, and they're all changing to rainbow flags right now, right? So you had Target most recently, Coles and the Major League Baseball and all these kind of things, where they started, you know, really hard pushing the, or continuing to push the LGBTQ thing, and then found that the consumer market pushed back by boycotting them, which to me tells me that there's something happening within the culture, that people are willing to vote with their wallets, mm-hmm. and to vote and to shop according to convictions. Mm-hmm. Actually, one platform that's on the rise now is Public Square, which allows people basically to shop at alternatives than the big box stores that are all pushing the woke agenda, and gives them alternatives basically that won't do that. And I think it was actually started by a Christian. I'm pretty sure somebody connected to He Who Shall Not Be Named's church, Doug Wilson's church. I think, I'm not sure, 100% sure, but yeah. That sort of thing gets me excited, because it kind of is like, maybe the culture is ripe for that. Maybe it's so fed up of like what's being shoved down its throat through woke corporations that it might be refreshing for a business to be like, you know, we're gonna just be Christian, like super based, traditional values, like, and you know,
yeah. So I think
unapologetic in that.
I think that I that makes me excited too.
Yeah.
The idea of businesses that decide that that they are going to be just very publicly aligned, and I think it's also, there's a whole lot of things that go on with that.
Yeah.
And I don't think that that means that every single business that is run by a Christian must be that.
No.
And so I think it's important that if your business is a Christian, like if you are a Christian business owner, you want to make sure that your faith influences every aspect of your business. There's no room for saying like, okay, well, we commit fraud in our business, but it's just our business because we're not publicly Christian.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. You know, that sort of thing.
Well, and not only that, in terms of the explicit sins, but also in terms of like the quality of the service and product that you provide, right? If you're, especially, I think if you're going to be an explicitly Christian business, and even if you're not, if you're just a Christian with a business, you should excel and strive to produce something so excellent that even if people found out that you were Christian and they didn't like that, they're like, well, yeah, but they produce like really good stuff, and I need to have this. Yes. Like, you know, think about, okay, I'm going to use an example. Max, Apple, right? Like, everybody hates to love them.
right?
But, and even for myself, being like a former, I'll never have a Mac guy, I'm not a Mac guy.
Converted you at
Converted. Reluctantly so. But because they produce an actually just excellent product.
Yes.
Right? And I look at that, I'm just like, you know, we can learn something from that. I think Christians should be producing excellent quality.
Yes. Stuff, you know? And that is worship in itself.
Yeah, absolutely. That's worship. And potentially pragmatically helpful too, because then the world can't ignore you.
Yes.
I mean, if you're like the annoying Christian guy, but then you have a subpar kind of mediocre business and product, then
it's not helping anything.
Yeah, nobody's going to pay any attention. But like, if you're producing excellence and maybe even innovation, like you invent something new that the world's like, whoa, we want that thing.
Yes.
Oh, but you're Christian.
Right.
And then they're like, you know, hit with that conundrum of, well, we can't really ignore him. What do we do here?
Yes. And the thing here, I think, is there's different layers of this.
Yeah.
So there are some businesses that have decided they're going to, like, second line of text on the front page of their website is going to say something about Christ.
Yeah.
Right. And it's all over. And so you have that kind of explicitly Christian. Mm-hmm. And then you have, you know, businesses that have decided that they're going to put this in their about section about their values, and which is also pretty public and explicit. And then there's also businesses that are not doing that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a point at which I think you cross into becoming afraid of man.
Right.
There's a whole range of like, okay, how out there are we going to like put crosses on our chocolate bars that we sell? There's like, okay, it's not like you're not a Christian if you don't do that.
And that's not the argument I'm making.
I know it's
just
not.
For the clarity of the listeners.
Right? Right. But then there's also a point at which you get so far, you know, there's that sometimes maligned quote that you should preach the gospel always, but if necessary, use words, which just is not particularly scriptural at all.
No.
you preach the gospel with words.
Yes.
Your actions should reflect Christ, but you need to use words to preach the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think if you come out and are like, well, I'm a Christian and I own a business and we make, you know, fantastic products.
Mm.
And I think that people are just going to get to know Jesus because we make fantastic products. There's, I think that is coward cowardice,
yeah,
disguised as,
or at least naivete.
Yes. And yeah, so it's something to think about, though. Right. It's like, okay, how are we creating a business that honors Christ?
Right.
And what does that actually look like? Yeah. Especially in, you know, our particular culture.
Yeah. That's good. All right, so let's move on to the next section. We talked about building strong Christian families, Christian churches, Christian businesses, as all integral parts of building strong Christian communities that you can create a culture of strength by which you can potentially impact the larger culture, mm-hmm, right? But the last one that I wanted us to dwell a little bit on, and we already touched on it before, is Christian education and just the importance of that as well, right? I'm going to read a quote, well, part of a quote from a book that we both read by Douglas Wilson called Gashmu Seyethid.
Yeah.
It's a easy read, thin book, actually, yes, thin.
Great book.
Yes. It could be called a booklet, but it has a hardcover. It is
I think the hardcover makes it a book.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. So, you know, if you're looking to get your Goodreads numbers up, this is a good one to read. It's an easy read, a short read, but has some really insightful things about communities, what we're talking about right now. So Doug is talking, my buddy Dougie. He's talking about in the context of, like, you know, of education and how when, you know, a family gives their kids over unthinkingly to be indoctrinated, really, by schools that are promoting godless ideologies, how sometimes they're kind of like, what happened? Like, little Johnny was such a good boy. Mm. Yeah. And then, like, you know, because they're reaping kind of what they sowed. And he says, you know, we often act astonished when we have no right whatsoever to be surprised in any way. We say wide-eyed with Aaron that all we did was put in a bunch of gold and out came this calf. And that has to rank as one of the lamest excuses in the Bible, and here we are still using it. And that's sharp, mm, but profound too, right? That, you know, I think one of the reasons our societies and particularly Christian culture has gone down the way it has is this neglect of education, thinking intentionally about that, and particularly giving a godly education, a Christian education to kids. Mm-hmm. Vodi has a famous saying, right, that if you hand your kids over to Caesar, don't be surprised if they come back as Romans,
mm-hmm,
right? Let's talk a little bit about that, about how Christian education is really foundational to building good, strong societies and cultures.
Yeah, well, I think the beginning of the end for this came several hundred years ago when we let the government get into education.
Mm-hmm.
And there was people at the time who were ringing alarm bells about this, saying that if we let the government be in education, you know, before you know it, they won't be teaching catechisms and they won't be doing prayers. And
Actually, I have a quote for that. So Earl Dabney, he's writing in the 19th century, he said this, that Christians must prepare themselves then for the following results, talking about how we give the state the role of educating, right? Mm-hmm. He said that Christians should prepare themselves for the following results. All Bibles, prayers, and catechisms will be ultimately driven out of the school. Now, he writes that back when the education system was overtly Protestant,
mm-hmm,
which is crazy inside, right? Like, yes. I mean, you had literally Christian schools run by the government.
Yes.
And Dabney was already saying that, like, y'all listen up. If this happens, Bibles, prayers, catechism are going to be out of school. And exactly that has happened.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so almost by definition, I would say, we probably need to give up the crusade to try and save the schools.
Mm.
By definition, government schools are not going to teach a Christian worldview.
Mm-hmm.
They might teach some sort of, you know, mythically neutral worldview that will end up not being neutral in the end.
Mm.
And what we've been seeing progressively is that they teach something that is overtly anti-Christian now.
Yeah.
But it seems that it hasn't quite caught up with us that that's what's happening. But we see it in what's happening to the children in the church, who there's all sorts of problems coming from mental health issues to you know, worldview issues, to morality issues.
Yeah.
And so I think that's something that we need to urgently rethink.
Yeah.
And there's a bunch of different ways that we can do that. So there's options, but it's something that needs to be figured out pronto.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think, like, you know, that's important to make clear too, that there are multiple options of how Christians may legitimately do this, right? Mm-hmm. Like in terms of homeschooling, in terms of private Christian schooling, even in terms of co-ops and hiring a teacher amongst like 10 families or whatever, right?
Which I'm hearing a lot of recently.
Yeah, yeah. Like those are legitimate ways that you can do that. And I think primarily the dads, like the fathers, need to take primary responsibility for this and realize that that's what scripture gives them. Ephesians 6 says the fathers train your kids up in the discipline and the education of the Lord, right? And that's very, very important. I'm actually going to do an episode either before or after this one releases on exactly that verse and what it means. But at minimum, it means that the fathers must give to their kids or ensure that their kids have a Christian education. Mm-hmm. Like, God's not giving fathers the task to like just give them any old education, and definitely not a pagan one, right? So I think that needs to fall on the fathers as seeing as, okay, this is my primary responsibility in terms of a dad. I need to be sure that my kid is getting a Christian education, because now, there's no such thing as a neutral education.
Yeah. Well, I think you're about to touch on it. I was going to say, someone might say, well, but like, how can math be Christian or not Christian? And so what if I send my kids to public school to learn, you know, math and English, and then I teach them the gospel at home?
Right.
You know, what would you say to that?
Yeah, I think that person has a disjointed Christian worldview, right? They think that the gospel only has to do with the spiritual realm. But the gospel is good news for all of creation and all of life too, right? The gospel is far more encompassing than we sometimes think. We sometimes think it's only justification, which is an important part of it that you never lose. And we think that it only means in terms of getting to heaven spiritually, right? But it's not just about that. God is interested in the redemption of all things. Christ has come to redeem all of creation, right? Even the creation itself is groaning for that redemption, right? That's what Romans 8 says. So we need to expand our horizons in terms of how we think about the gospel and gospel ministry. We also need to expand how we think about every aspect of life being related back to your worldview. Like, the person who says that, well, math is neutral, like numbers are neutral, they're probably not aware that right now there's literally people and teachers in Ontario. I saw a news article the other day that are saying that math, traditional math, is racist. Where is that coming from? Right. It's coming from a worldview, right? And it's not a Christian one. So there are worldview issues that have practical implications, even to subjects such as math, right? Because the reason math works is because God exists. Ultimately, it comes down to that. Mm-hmm. God has created an orderly system within this universe, and he's a God of order, not of chaos. And this is why science works. This is why we can expect uniformity in nature and predictability within math even. That's the ultimate standard by which all of those things derive from. You don't get that from a chaotic universe that has no designer behind it, right? Those things only come from the God of, the true God of the Bible, right? And I think like we've tended to separate our thought as Christians in this dualistic fashion of the spiritual, and then there's everything else, right? The secular, which is not a biblical way of thinking about reality. No. Like, all of life, in a sense, is spiritual. Actually, it's interesting. Romans 12, Paul says to offer your bodies, what, as a living sacrifice, as what? Your spiritual act of worship. Yeah. He's saying that your physical body being offered to God is a part of spiritual worship. So clearly, spirituality in biblical conception doesn't just have to do with the ethereal, non-physical realm. It has implications on the material realm as well, too, and on all areas of life. So I would say something akin to that, probably.
Yes. And so we can have Christian phys ed classes in schools as well.
Absolutely.
And honor Christ through you know, developing.
Yeah. Well, a good way to illustrate this is, like, just take the issue of science, right? That's often touted as like a neutral way to meet people on, right? Like, well, we should just let science decide these issues. How's that gone, following the science in the past couple of years, right? Science, we've seen, can be manipulated in various ways, and that has to do with the worldview that's behind it. Mm. Also, even just back down to the bare bones, you know, let's say hard sciences of like physics, chemistry, etc., right? Still impacted by worldview. So take, for example, somebody who has a Darwinistic evolutionary view of reality. How are they going to operate as a biologist, for example, or even as a chemist, right? That's going to impact the way that they even do their science. That impacts our medical field right now in terms of how doctors are trained, in terms of how research is done, and so on. If it's with this presupposition of Darwinistic evolution, then the presupposition behind that is this world is not designed. That's why we need to synthesize everything. Mm. Like, we shouldn't expect that nature would have all that we need to flourish because it's not designed by a loving creator. But a Christian shouldn't think that way. A Christian should think, well, no, a loving God created with wisdom this world, and then created it especially 6 days before, you know, he put us in it.
Right.
So he created it in an environment in which we could flourish, where we would be able to find the things that we need in order to live healthily and to flourish and so on. So I think that should also impact how you think as a Christian, even about things like biology and medicine and those sort of things. That's the presupposition that should come into it. But if you have a naturalistic, you know, presupposition, you think that, well, we shouldn't expect that because reality is not designed, right?
Mm-hmm. I think that there might be a lot of people who are saying, okay, I see the value of Christian education, and I see how it's important to teach our kids from a Christian worldview.
Yeah.
A lot of what I hear is people saying, yeah, but it's too expensive.
Yeah.
And so I think that that's
facts.
Thinking strategically and thinking long term, that's something we're going to have to figure out what do we do about that? And one of the big opportunities, I think, there is for churches to either subsidize or, I think, preferred for the churches themselves to start their own schools.
Yeah.
I mean, either option works well.
Right.
But you want to make sure that you have a school that is not just Christian in name, that's like a public school that they've just slapped a few Bible verses on.
Yeah.
You actually want to make sure that you're thinking a distinctively Christian way about your education.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that probably means doing some things radically different than we've been used to education. And there's a lot of things about education that we do I don't think we really think about. It's just that this is the way it's done. It's like, well, we pack 30 kids in a room and we give them one teacher and get them to teach them stuff.
Yep.
And it's like, okay, well, is that the best way of doing it?
Yeah.
And
or we train them to take exams.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, the exams drive me crazy. Because exams don't teach you how to actually apply knowledge in the real world.
No, I think there's a place for it. It's usually in the grammar phase of like education where you're just trying to memorize brute facts and get the core building blocks to then build an actual education.
Yes.
So I think that's fine. Like vocabulary tests and those sorts of things are ways to build that because you need that as a building block first to begin with. But later on, as you're moving to, you know, more advanced curriculum and so on, where you should be developing your skills of logic, let's say, standardized testing is a little bit, has to either look differently or should be just jettisoned altogether in favor of more practical ways of assessing performance and so on, such as project-based learning and, apprenticeships and so on.
Yes, and it's important, I think, to remember that the reason for assessing is to figure out whether you're serving the students well and whether you should change something so that they learn better.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, we've gotten to this point where the like grades are currency almost.
Yeah.
In very real ways, your grades will make you money.
Yes.
And so I think that we've got to this point where people are pursuing grades for the grade's sake, and the grades should be a tool towards learning stuff that is useful for life or is useful theology is useful for life.
Right.
But, learning stuff that is useful and helps us to understand the world better.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Not like, oh, I got a few red checks and a few green checks and we add them all up.
Right. Yeah, we could keep going on about like, you know, models of education, but I think that would derail us a little bit. Let's come back to how it fits into this idea of building strong communities, right? I think part of it is education really is the foundation for strong communities. So think about how was one of the primary ways that our culture shifted and became where it's at right now in terms of the craziness, and even where the craziness currently is. Like, drag queen story hours are happening in schools for a reason, right? It's because those are the centers that then build the next generation of what the culture will look like, right? So if we want to retake the culture, if we want to see any change happen, or if you even just want to create strong Christian cultures and communities, like, we have to be focused on education. I think it's one of the great oversights of a lot of churches today is that they haven't really placed a lot of emphasis or thought in terms of, okay, if we want to, even if we want our church to flourish in the next generation, we have to start thinking this way.
Yes.
Because even if we keep the current generation in the church and they're sending their kids to public school who are being indoctrinated in secular ideologies, we'll lose them.
Yes.
Like, because there's no way the math works out. They're going to school for, you know, more than 40 hours or whatever a week, and then they get 2 hours of church on Sunday, right? Like, just doesn't work out. Like, the indoctrination is strong.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And it's, so thinking for the next generation is important. And also, developing Christian cultures, the education is very important. And I think one of the things we need to realize there is to stop being, in a sense, embarrassed about our Christian values. And feeling like, oh, we wouldn't possibly want to, you know, impose these on anyone.
Yeah.
And we certainly, you can't impose values on someone and expect them to accept them. Mm. But
that's what the public school does all the time.
It is.
That's what like our culture is doing, is imposing its values on us. Like, I think it's unavoidable, the, so to speak, imposition of values. Indoctrination happens regardless, right? It's just a matter of what you're being indoctrinated with. Because there is no neutrality, what we talked about earlier, right?
Yeah.
So I think you're right. Like, we shouldn't be ashamed that we're like, yeah, we're wanting our kids to be Christians. Like, we're wanting to impose and like to indoctrinate them in Christ.
Yes. And what we're saying, what we should believe, if we're consistent biblical Christians, is that, well, Christ is the best thing, and Christ's way of life is the best way of life, and so. What we're actually trying to do is we're seeking the best for people. And I think sometimes we can say that sort of intellectually.
Yeah.
And then when the rubber really meets the road, we start to feel a little bit embarrassed that we're actually kind of taking actions based on that.
Hmm.
And so I think in our education, though, we should be distinctly trying to raise kids to be Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than the attitude that's sometimes taken is, well, we kind of present them with a buffet of options, and then we hope that they choose the one. We hope and pray that they choose the one that we really think they should.
And that's another way that, like, I think a lot of churches shy away from talking clearly too, right? They, in a sense, some pastors try to take a neutral approach to the topic of education and presenting in such a way that, like, if it's equal choices and you, whichever one you choose, it doesn't matter, right?
Yes.
Like, you could send your kids to public school and be taught by a drag queen, or you could send them to, you know, this Christian private school, you can homeschool, it's all up to you.
Right.
Like, no.
Yeah,
like,
right.
Some of those are bad choices,
yes.
Right? And I think we should stop with that facade of, like, you know, that it's all a buffet, it's all the same thing, and you can, like, you know, do whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
Especially want to be faithful to that scripture that, you know, multiple scriptures that tell us that we owe our kids a Christian education, and that we will be held, particularly as fathers, accountable to that. That's a charge that needs to be come from the front, from pastors, particularly because they model that. Like, you look at the qualifications for an elder, it's all in the home and how he leads his family. And also, one of the qualifications is what his children are believing. There's some ways of translating it. Now, you can translate it different ways, but you can also translate it faithful. Either way, though, it implies that he's given his kids a Christian education at the very least.
Yes.
Right? So I think, like, it has to start from the front within church communities and so on, in Christian communities, being committed to both preaching and educating the people on that, but also putting their money where their mouth is, so to speak. Because if you're going to tell, similarly, like, you know, telling your community, hey, stand for truth and we got your back. Similarly, if you're going to tell them you need to give your kids a Christian education, you have to know that there's going to be some people who financially, they can't make that work.
Yes.
Right? And that would be such a powerful thing for church communities to do, to say, well, we're so committed to this. We want you to be able to give your kids a Christian education, whether that's homeschool, you know, co-ops, or classical Christian education, whatever. And if you can't, like, come talk to us. We'll figure out something. We've got, like, a fund that we've put away to do this. We've got ways to subsidize. We've started a co-op where we're hiring a teacher to come in and teach, you know, families in the church. And here's how you can, you know, be involved.
Yes.
I
think churches should think about the resources that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of churches. I mean, some churches are mobile churches. They don't have a building.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of churches that have a building with numerous rooms and classrooms that are almost completely empty every weekday.
Yeah.
And so, you know, space is pretty valuable, especially, you know, in Ontario, Canada. Stuff is wild expensive.
Yes.
And so a big part of the cost of running an education would be the space to run it in. The church already has the space.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, there's a big cost down. Mm. Or, you know, there's a lot of churches will spend a lot of money on a whole bunch of other various budget items.
Yeah.
And you could think, what difference could we make with that same money if we put it into
what's the ROI?
Yeah, return. And I think we should think about things that way a bit more than we do. We should think of, like, okay, how many lives can we change with this dollar?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And if we thought about that, we might spend our money a little bit differently.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
But think about the return of investment for using the classrooms you already have in your church and hiring a teacher to teach, you know, 10, 20, 30 students.
Yeah.
And then you can, you know, even if the parents have some contribution to it, it's still, you've lowered the barrier for entry so much.
Yeah.
That now Christian education is a real possibility for people who financially it just was not previously.
Yeah, yeah. And this was something I brought up in the talk I gave recently, that, you know, this is in our DNA. You look at all the Ivy League schools in North America, they all started as Christian institutions, like Princeton, Yale, all of them, right? Like, they all started from Christian Protestants, actually.
Yeah.
right? So very Protestant impulse to do that.
Yeah.
And part of the reasoning behind that historically was that Protestants understood that, well, people need to understand the Bible. You need to be able to read the Bible. Mm-hmm. And in order to read and properly understand and interpret the Bible, you need to be educated.
Yeah.
It's not just basic literacy, because the Bible is a complex book as well. So you need to be able to understand logic, reasoning, grammar, history, all these different things. So that was why there was such a huge impetus towards education. And I think we need to regain that heritage, right, as Christians, yes. That like we should be leading the way in education instead of handing it off to the state. That Christians and churches, obviously, every church is different and has different capabilities. So I'm not advocating that every single church needs to start a school. No. But I think there are some churches that's within their possibility, that yes. they could and should seriously consider. And for the ones who can't, like, need to consider other ways, more creative ways of doing that. Like we said, via co-ops or even just encouraging and giving good resources. Sometimes that's all parents need. If you tell, like, I've spoken to different Christian brothers too, like, yeah, we'd like to homeschool. We don't like what's going on in the public school, but we don't even know where to start. We don't know resources. We don't know how to choose curriculum. Well, that's a way that the church can come in and help too, where it's like, here's a curated list,
yes.
right? Here's good curriculum. Yes. Have at it. Like, just buy it and go for it, you know? Yes. And we'll be here to a support group, maybe even have some training seminars, right? And that's pretty cheap in terms of, like, budget that you need to allocate towards that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And there's other, all sorts of other options. You have a co-op, and your pastor comes once a week to teach a theology class to these, you know, 10, 15 students.
Yeah.
That, you know, the pastor is already salaried. The pastor has already probably been doing sermon prep on these things and reading the commentaries and the theology and knows the stuff. It's not going to be that much extra in terms of time and effort to encourage. And I think a lot of that is just saying, hey, we think this is a good idea.
Yeah.
And we're here for you.
Yeah.
And we want to help. And I think a lot of the times where people falter in Christian education, especially in things like homeschooling, is it starts to feel lonely and it starts to feel like no one understands and no one's really here for us. And so if we can encourage people that, no, this is valuable work.
Yeah. And even for the homeschoolers, it's important to have that cooperation, because it's almost impossible you're going to have, let's say, a stay-at-home mom who's homeschooling be excellent at all these different subjects.
Yes.
Just probably not going to happen.
Yes.
You might have like the one like special gem who would be, right? But being able to cooperate within a community that's committed to this would help to fill in those gaps, right? Because maybe one family is really good at math or whatever, another one's good at the arts or whatever. And like you can have cooperation within even homeschooling networks and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, there's so many opportunities, and I'm excited for the potential for all of this. And I see a lot more people realizing the necessity of not just doing things the way that we've always done them, but starting to think, okay, maybe things are different now, and maybe we need to really take some of this seriously.
Yeah.
And so I'm optimistic about that.
Yeah.
But optimism is not enough. You actually have to, you know, put some boots on the ground and
do it. Yeah.
And so
Nike, they got it right. Just do it.
Just do it.
Yeah. And that's, I think another, like, maybe we should end here. Another thing about it too is like, I feel like sometimes we're too worried about having every nitty-gritty detail figured out before we jump in and do something. Mm-hmm. Now, I get that there's wisdom towards, you know, planning, wise execution. Like, scripture talks to that as well, too, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, it's a fool who goes out to war without first counting whether he can actually win the battle, right? So, yes, plan, for sure. But don't get so stuck in it that you don't actually just start doing, because some of this you don't learn until you start doing, right? That some of it is going to take some trial and error. And I think that's okay. Like, let's say if a church has got this vision, they're like, okay, we want to start a Christian school. Maybe they just start with a grade school or whatever. Be okay and tell the parents too, like, listen, we're new to this. Like, we're figuring out your kids are like the first batch and they're going to be guinea pigs. And you know what? A lot of parents would probably be okay with that. They'd much rather you experiment on the kids than the state, right?
Yes.
And also something to just tack on to that too is like, within this conversation of Christian education, is not just thinking of it as like slapping a Christian veneer over these different subjects or just bringing in the pastor to teach theology. It's actually teaching these subjects from a Christian worldview, right? And how does thinking Christianly about math, about biology, about, you know, physics, about business, about all these different things, how is that done in a specifically Christian way, right? That's really important, because otherwise there's plenty of Christian schools that actually end up giving a secular education with some devotionals.
Yes.
Right? You don't want that.
No. What a waste of effort.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. I think that's a good place to end it. Hopefully you guys enjoyed this little conversation being a fly on the wall with Josh and I. I'm sure we'll be doing lots more episodes together.
Yes.
I actually just want to give Josh a opportunity to plug his new business here. Why don't you tell the folks here, speaking about Christian businesses, tell us, what do you do and how you're building and reforming the community here? Just kidding.
Right.
So
algonquindigital.com, we do a bunch of different things related to digital media. So video production, audio production, and then also, you know, professional AV installation for churches and organizations, acoustics, all that sort of related area of things, and trying to love especially to serve Christian organizations and Christian businesses to make their media as impactful as it can be. Mm-hmm. Love to do that.
Yeah, awesome. Great. Kind of related to my business as well, too.
And
so we're a great partnership here.
There you go. You can hire both of us.
Yeah, there you go. All right, cool.
Great.
Well, hope you guys enjoyed it. Until next time, soli Deo Gloria.
Thanks for listening to the Theotivity podcast. If you found this content helpful or edifying, please leave a review on Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Also, follow us on social media and consider sharing this episode to help Theotivity reach others as well. Check out theotivity.com for resources, info on how to support, and subscribe to our monthly newsletter to stay up to date on all the latest content. Until next time, live and create to the glory of God.